This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Failing to protect mothers. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
A comprehensive four-year investigation by USA Today has found that moms in the U.S. suffer avoidable deaths as doctors ignore well-known protocols.
How old social media posts could hurt your job prospects.
The latest alcohol crisis gripping parts of Europe.
And how single people go for broke when it comes to online dating.
A study came out this week that showed that people swipe on potential partners that are on average 25% out of their league, if that is quantifiable. So obviously if you receive more messages, that would imply that you are more desirable or more sought after. And so people are consistently swiping right on others who are 25% more desirable based on how much engagement they are getting.
Market Watch reporter Carrie Paul explains how online dating can be like fantasy football. She's here later in the hour. Well, every year, thousands of women suffer life-altering injuries or die during childbirth because hospitals and medical workers skip safety practices that are known to head off disaster. A new and comprehensive investigation by USA Today has found that doctors and nurses should be doing things like weighing bloody pads to track blood loss, so they recognize the danger sooner. Also, they should be giving medication within an hour of spotting dangerously high blood pressure to fend off strokes. Why isn't this being done? Investigative reporter Allison Young has been asking around for 4 years to piece together this story. Allison, set this up.
So one of the things that USA Today was exploring is the question is, why is the United States one of the wealthiest countries in the world that spends so much on health care? Why is our rate of women dying and suffering very serious harms during childbirth, why is it going up here when it's going down in peer countries? And one of the things that we found is that while there has been a lot of public discussion that essentially blames the women themselves for what's going on in this country, the reality is that the medical care that they're receiving or not receiving is also partially to blame.
How so?
So what we found is that maternity hospitals across the country are failing to follow best medical practices. These are things that have been known for years to make childbirth safer. And the result of that is that women are suffering these needless, serious harms and in some cases dying.
Goodness. So what are some of these basic protocols that are being ignored?
Sure. So two of the leading preventable causes of maternal deaths and serious injuries are hemorrhage and dangerously high blood pressure conditions such as preeclampsia. But what experts have found is that in both of these areas, better medical care can dramatically reduce the number of women who are being harmed or dying. So with hemorrhage, what happens there is that experts have found that health professionals often fail to recognize when a normal amount of bleeding from childbirth crosses the line and becomes a potentially deadly hemorrhage. And part of the reason for that is that hospitals and nurses across the country, in many cases, are just simply looking at the amount of blood. They're taking an educated guess and eyeballing it to determine how much has been lost. But for years, studies have warned that these visual estimates often underestimate the blood loss. And when you underestimate blood loss, you delay giving women effective treatments to stop the bleeding and replace blood that they're losing. This is incredibly important because you need to do this fast to avoid things sort of snowballing. And there has been a coalition of leading medical societies who have put together something called the AIM program, and they are pushing for maternity hospitals across the country to instead really measure the blood loss, to weigh blood-soaked items and collect blood in calibrated containers. That's one of the examples of things that is not happening that is leading to needless deaths and harms.
I'm speaking with Allison Young, investigative reporter at USA Today. She's written a comprehensive piece, part of a series. It's called Hospitals Know How to Protect Mothers. They just aren't doing it. One thing that jumped out at me You wrote, today, this is the most dangerous place in the developed world to give birth. I mean, put that in perspective. Like, is that like per childbirth or like just flat out numbers? How do you explain it?
It's not flat out numbers. It's the rate. So it's the rate that these kinds of deaths happen. I mean, you obviously wouldn't do it with absolute counts because you're talking about something where some countries are smaller or greater. But when you look at other countries, I mean, whether it is the United Kingdom or Canada, I mean, the U.S. is significantly higher in the rate at which women are dying from these childbirth-related conditions. And one of the issues is that, especially, I mean, the United Kingdom is held up as really sort of a place that a lot of other countries are trying to emulate. They have spent a lot more time studying exactly why women in their country are dying and really sort of putting forth, you know, what are the lessons learned from these deaths and how can we basically put forth best practices across our medical system in that country to reduce those deaths. In the United States, we have a culture that gives enormous latitude for individual doctors to practice medicine as they see fit. And we see that in our country as something that's a good thing. But it also has negative consequences because it does not mean that there are as many standardized best practices and protocols, and you can't necessarily count on the same level of care at any individual institution.
Man. How about some of the injuries?
Oh, the injuries, I mean, are just devastating for some of these women. So, I mean, one of the things that, you know, there's a lot of attention paid to women who die from these childbirth conditions, and those are just horrible, horrible situations. And about 700 women a year die in the United States, but 50,000 women a year, let that number sink in, 50,000 women a year suffer very serious adverse events related to childbirth. So these are women who end up hemorrhaging and needing transfusions. They end up on ventilators. They end up in the ICU. They don't get to bond with their babies. And one of the things that we made a point of focusing on in this series in USA Today is on the women who are part of that 50,000. But these women tell these harrowing stories. They talk about how they weren't listened to when warning signs were cropping up. They talk about their frustrations. And they also talk about those who ultimately saved them. But it is just a huge window on the scope of the harms. And these things have devastating consequences for women that they live with for the rest of their lives.
All right. Thanks, Allison. Allison Young, investigative reporter at USA Today. Is it a remarkable story? Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 most improved state for business, Michigan. Contact MichiganBusiness.org today. More companies are scouring your online persona for racist and other red flag comments. With JobRecruit's social media histories readily available, more employers are trying to head off or prepare for controversies, especially with high-profile hires. But as Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Feinsig has discovered, social media trails can morph into hiring minefields. Rachel, what's up here?
So more and more companies are delving into employees as well as job seekers, kind of social media histories. And then we've also had some high-profile instances recently where things have come out that employers either weren't aware of or they were aware of and okay with, but mobs online were not. And so it's raising some interesting questions.
All right. So legal questions, I would imagine, are coming up here.
Yeah, there's a lot of legal uncertainty, it sounds like. I've talked to an employment lawyer as well as a human resources consultant, and they just said there's still a lot of gray area. You know, some of these newer privacy laws, like in Europe, like really just debuted, and it's kind of unclear, like, what you can and can't do with some of this. Other legal issues include the fact that in some states, the employment lawyer told me, you could be liable if, let's say, you hire someone who was, you know, tweeting racist things and then goes on to discriminate against hiring, you know, people of a certain ethnicity for your company. You know, that liability could be passed on to you as an employer. So there's kind of risks on both sides if you look and if you don't look.
Wow. So in that case, that could come back with somebody saying you should have known that this may or was possible that this could happen based on past tweets, for example.
Yeah, that's what this lawyer was insinuating. She said it, you know, depends on like state rules, but that's the case in some places. And so she urges all of her clients to actually do social media checks, whereas some other folks I talked to said they they don't want their clients to be doing social media checks because it just brings up so many privacy and bias issues. Another problem is, let's say you're just looking for racist tweets for like a huge red flag, but you stumble on some sort of protected information, like the person has a disability or they're pregnant. Like, it's really hard to say what if that information makes its way into your brain and biases you against the person in some way. So there's just kind of risks on all sides.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal management reporter Rachel Feinzig. She's written a piece entitled Past Social Media Posts Upend Hiring. So if you are a hiring manager and you're looking at a potential employee's social media posts and it's a public account, could you say, hey, so I saw on Twitter from 6 years ago where you said this or you used this particular, you know, controversial phrase or something like that? I mean, can you do that?
With most of the experts I talk to, they actually don't have the hiring manager doing it. So they actually often have, folks from human resources doing this so that to kind of prevent that bias from taking root in the hiring manager's mind. And so the HR person who's not directly involved in the hiring decision will look. If they find something, they will reach out to the job applicant or employee usually and say, was this not really you? Can you explain this? And then based on that, they'll go to the hiring manager and either give them a green light or a red light on whether or not they recommend hiring. In the case of this one employment letter I was talking to, she doesn't want them passing on a ton of information. It's really just a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And again, just based on what they found, looking for kind of racist information, sexist information, like people stress to me, like this is not about someone holding a beer in their hand. This is about, stuff that's really inflammatory. Although again, you could be kind of seeing that other stuff, so it's hard to know where the line really gets drawn.
Holy cow. Explain some of these high-profile incidents that have come up lately.
Yep, there were a couple in the New York Times, one more recently with tweets that were apparently racist against white people, a lot of like anti-white sentiment. In that case, the New York Times said they knew about this before hiring this person, and I, believe that they're standing by their decision. There was someone else who had tweets, talked about a friendship with a neo-Nazi, and other stuff that was kind of tinged with race. And that person, that was from a little while ago, and that person did ultimately end up not joining the Times after kind of a big outcry. There's been other stuff with Major League Baseball players. There's been stuff from Disney. It's really been across the board in terms of industries.
Thanks, Rachel. It's Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Feinzig. Do you dread trips to the gas station? Well, a Silicon Valley startup that functions like a mobile gas station using field technicians, as they're called, to fill up vehicles when they're not being driven just may be your solution. The company, known as Yoshi, is part of a crop of gas delivery startups billing themselves as, quote, Uber for gasoline. More from Peter Hawley, tech reporter at The Washington Post. Peter, explain this.
I didn't know so many people disliked going to gas stations, but apparently there's a lot of people out there who cannot stand filling up their car with gas. So there's a new company. It's called Yoshi. It's actually been around for 3 years, but they've been expanding lately all over the country. And you can hire them to come and fill your car up with gas, as well as do other kind of gas station services, like fill up your tires, do a car wash. It's considered a mobile gas station.
Is that named after the Mario Kart character by any chance?
It actually is. I'm not sure what the exact connection is, but I do know that they did get the name from the old SNL Mario Kart thing.
How about that? So how does it work? That doesn't sound to me like you could just decide as you pull into a gas station and a downpour starts that you can say, oh, geez, I'd love to have somebody fill up my tank, am I wrong?
No, you're right. So the way it works is you sign up with Yoshi beforehand. You set a schedule with them. There's an app, and you create the schedule by which they come and find you. So if you want to have your car filled up at your office, or if you want to do it at home, they'll come to you. They'll fill it up, and you communicate with them via app, actually via a bot on your app. So if they notice that your tires are flat, you'll get a little text notification that says, hey, do you want us to fill up your tires as well as give you gas? And then you respond and communicate with them accordingly.
Oh, so they have all your car information.
They do, and yeah. That's actually something I didn't cover in the story, but maybe is a future story. they do have your information. They are collecting some amount of data about you and your habits, and at some point this will be valuable data. They're not selling it to third parties at this point, but in the future that could definitely be the case.
Wow. All right, so you could tell by my line of questioning early on that I'm a New Jersey guy and I do not have to pump my own gas. So I was thinking you pull into a gas station and you can choose to have somebody pump your gas, but this is like your car is at home or you're at the office or you're out somewhere.
Yeah, this is even better if you're into people pumping gas for you. This means you go anywhere you want in the world and they come and find you, assuming it's in they're in your city. So it's really, you know, catering to people who are busy professionals who don't have time or say they don't have time to do basic things like pump their own gas.
We're speaking with Peter Hawley, technology reporter at The Washington Post. You wrote, too, not everybody's comfortable with this idea of a startup lugging around tanks of flammable liquid, as you put it. What's are there regulations that these guys are facing?
There have been pushback in various cities along the West Coast. It seems like Yoshi, and there's other startups like Yoshi, there's a handful that'll bring you gas. They are tailoring their services to local cities and trying to follow local laws. They claim they haven't had a single incident, but there's definitely pushback from fire marshals in certain cities who are terrified of the idea of a massive truck going underneath a parking garage with flammable gas. Now, Yoshi does train its field technicians. Those are the guys who actually go out and put the gas in your car. They are hazmat certified. Like I said, there hasn't been an incident, but, you know, it does make you wonder.
All right, thanks, Peter. Peter Hawley, tech reporter at The Washington Post. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for four straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan as the most improved state for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for spending time with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka coming up this half hour. How the investment landscaping is changing thanks to something new from Fidelity Investments. Also, how single people are treating online dating like fantasy football. And the beer bottle crisis in Germany. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, losing one family member is hard enough. How does anyone deal with multiple losses? After a duck boat accident killed 9 members of one family in Missouri, others who have weathered unimaginable grief are sharing their experiences. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Claire Ansbury, the Wall Street Journal, has talked to people who have weathered unimaginable grief and joins us now. Claire, what are some of the challenges that these folks are facing?
Well, usually when something is so shocking like this, it's not the trajectory that we expect in life. You know, everybody experiences loss and death, but usually it's at the end of a life. And when you have a tragedy or a trauma or accident, massive accident, you're losing people at earlier times and unexpected times. Nobody expects to lose their child.
I read somewhere that grief never, ever goes away. You just somehow learn to live with it. How did some of these folks learn to live with their grief?
Well, and that's so true that it never goes away. And most of them say that they just learn how to cope with it. You know, the world is never going to be the same, so they just have to live in it. And, you know, some of them, and it's a trial and error thing where they learned, you know, one woman said that, you know, she just wanted to be by herself and she didn't want to burden anybody with, you know, her own pain. But she realized that she really needed to talk to people and not shut out the people that she loved. And that was one thing that was really important to her. You know, other people said that they needed to find hope in something and some sense of purpose. You know, they felt like their whole life had ended. And, you know, some people can find new projects or some sort of thing that honors the people who have died and sort of continue their memory. You know, there's a lot of people find strength in some sort of spiritual, journey where, you know, their life, they're seeking meaning in their life and they find it in their spiritual practices. Service. People also find a lot of help in serving others. But the important thing, too, is that, you know, that's something that happens after time. And, you know, everyone has said, look, you know, after something like this, the grieving period, you know, it's lifelong, but you can't rush things. And you really need to be patient with yourself, and people around you need to be patient as well, because it really, really takes a long time. So take care of yourself. You know, that grief is such a physically and emotionally and mentally exhausting thing, and you really need to take care of yourself first and go through the grief. There's really no avoiding it, and just kind of incorporate the loss in your own life before you can really sort of reach out.
We're speaking with Claire Ansbury of the Wall Street Journal. Claire, I know for your story, you talked to some people who have undergone unimaginable grief in their personal lives. You talked about some of those people turning something positive out of that by having a purpose. Can you give an example of how someone specifically did that?
Sure. Madonna Badger lost her 3 children and her parents in a fire, a Christmas morning fire. She herself escaped, and she went into severe depression. She was suicidal. Her whole life, she said, she just lost. And, you know, she went through a lot of counseling and to trauma centers, and she really just felt like, you know, something was wrong with her, and that she couldn't go on. And finally, a doctor said, look, you know, the loss of a mother and a child, I mean, that's the strongest bond. And when you lose it, it's like severing a nerve. And so she said that, you know, that kind of gave her hope. And she realized, look, I'm still the mother of these children. I'm still the daughter of my parents. And I want to live my life honoring them. She is a marketing executive, an advertising executive. So she launched a campaign for the industry to not objectify women. And in doing so, she wanted to honor women and girls and protect them. And that was something that she wanted to do for her daughters, and, you know, just to have a project with purpose.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal columnist Claire Ansbury. 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. Have you avoided investing because you could never come up with a minimum amount to deposit? Well, things just got a lot easier. Fidelity Investments has made a couple of recent changes, including dropping the required minimum investment on all funds and slashing expenses. But that does leave questions. Here's Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert and founder of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, what's happening here?
So what we've seen Fidelity do is 3 things. One, it introduced 2 new broad market index funds with 0 expenses. Nobody else has a fund out there with 0 expenses, but now Fidelity has 2 of them, 2 broad market index funds. Second, it slashed the expenses on all its other index funds so that almost all of them have expenses that are below those of their competitors. And then 3, what they've also done, which I think is super significant, is they've lowered the investment minimums on all of their funds, both their index funds and their actively managed funds, to 0. Previously, many of the funds had minimums of $2,500, but now you can get into any Fidelity fund for no money down.
All right. I know the cynic in you comes out here. What are your questions? First off, why is Fidelity doing this?
So you go back to the 1980s when I started writing about mutual funds, Gordon, and Fidelity was king of the hill. They had this unbelievable swagger. They were the place where you went to get market-beating returns. They were the home of Peter Lynch, manager of the Fidelity Magellan Fund. But since the 1980s, it's been all downhill for Fidelity. You know, obviously, with so many funds on offer, they always have 1 or 2 that are beating the market. But their reputation that being the outperformance house has gone away. People no longer think of Fidelity as that place where you always get market-beating returns. As a consequence, their growth has slowed, and they've been casting around for how to re-energize their growth. And what they've decided is, okay, we've got to get people in the door, and the best way to do it is, 1, slash the expenses on our index funds, and 2, lower the price of admission. So, in other words, you don't have to have any money to come here and invest.
All right. Sounds great. But you also say, is this a potential bait and switch opportunity for Fidelity? What do you make of that?
Well, if you go back to the late 80s and again into the early 90s, we saw price-cutting wars back then, one focused on money market funds, another focused on S&P 500 index funds. And what happened on those occasions was that fund companies would lower the minimums on the expenses on their funds, cash would come rolling in, and once the funds were bloated with assets, they would jack the fees back up, and suddenly people were caught in these funds and paying much higher fees than when they entered them. This time around, there's a chance that that's going to happen, that not just Fidelity, but also Schwab, which has been lowering expenses, also iShares, which has been lowering expenses, will indeed turn around and jack up the expenses on those funds, and people will find that they're paying much more than they expected. But I think not. I think the competitive environment is really so sharp, so competitive, that they can't afford to reverse these cuts. If they did, their reputation would be destroyed. So I think these lower expense ratios are going to stick this time around. Instead, as I see it, the bait and switch is of a slightly different nature. Fidelity, Schwab, iShares are getting people to buy into their funds with these lower expenses. Then they're hoping that people will turn around and buy other of their funds on which they charge higher expenses and on which they're going to be making good profits.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert and founder and editor of the website HumbleDollar.com. 13 minutes in front of the hour on This Weekend. Ledger with us. Confidence is key when dating, but is it possible to take your self-assurance too far? A new study finds most online daters are swiping right on people who are out of their league. More from MarketWatch reporter Carrie Paul. Carrie, what are we learning?
A study came out this week that showed that people swipe on potential partners that are on average 25% out of their league, if that is quantifiable, which in the study it was.
I was going to say, how is that? And what a shame that people think that way.
Right. So in this study, they quantified that based on a formula they used that looked at how many messages a person received from people. So obviously, if you receive more messages, that would imply that you are more desirable or more sought after. And so people are consistently swiping right on others who are 25% more desirable based on how much engagement they are getting.
Wow. I guess why not, right? I mean, that the social media basically allows you to do it.
Right. That's what we talked to some dating experts about. A lot of people are kind of using these apps as a game. They're swiping because it seems like there's no consequence to it. A lot of times you don't meet these people in person, so, you know, you might as well, as one person put it, shoot your shot and try to, you know, match with as great of people as you can, whether or not you think you have a chance with them.
It's interesting. The 25% in which you may be trying to date 25% out of your league, I guess, for lack of better terminology. That's based on all kinds of factors?
So in this particular study, it was just based on the number of messages the person received.
Okay.
Because you can't really quantify, you know, looks and other factors like that, which some people that we spoke with about the study called into question. Obviously, there's a lot of factors that go into desirability in terms of occupation, looks, sense of humor, things like that.
Yeah. What else factored in here in this study? What else did we learn?
Well, some people were talking about how this is kind of feeding into the burnout culture surrounding swipe-based dating apps. Some people are saying that the structure of these apps encourages people to pursue strangers that they may not have any hope of dating in real life.
Wow.
So it's kind of this concept of if a desired match doesn't happen, there's still a lot of out-of-their-league singles. You can keep swiping and swiping, and statistically you'll end up matching with a good number of people anyway.
What about that? Did the study find that you can actually achieve decent results by pursuing somebody who might be out of your league?
Well, we did speak to one single person who was saying that his current girlfriend he thought was out of his league, and then she thought that he was out of her league, so you never know.
Wow.
And now they are dating each other, so it could work out.
Thanks, Carrie. Carrie Paul, MarketWatch personal finance reporter. By the way, the study was done for the American Association for the Advancement of Science by the University of Michigan. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. The summer has not been kind to beer drinkers in Europe. First, there was a CO2 shortage in Russia, remember, during the World Cup. Now there's a beer bottle shortage. threatening the supply of brew in Germany. Due to a recent heat wave abroad, the country has seen an increase in beer consumption. But while there's no shortage of actual beer, NPR reports breweries are running low on bottles to put it in. Environmentally conscious Germans pay a small deposit on every glass of bottle that they buy, which they get back when it's returned to the store. However, bottles are being sold faster than they're being returned, leaving brewers in short supply. Breweries are making public appeals to thirsty customers, hoping they'll be inclined to return their empties. In order to solve this problem, some breweries are also turning to cans. But not everyone is on board with this idea. As one guy says, a bottle is just much more civilized. He told the NPR, a can is ergonomically wrong and the beer warms up too quickly. But mainly, he says, it just looks cheap and a bit trashy. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.